the method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening to Unsound Methods, this is a podcast where we usually speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique. But we're doing something a little bit different. So this is episode 31. There's no significance in that number particularly, but we're sort of deep into the coronavirus lockdown now. I think we're just having a bit of a stock take, maybe, aren't we, about our reading habits. I always say to people this is a podcast where we talk about writing and not books as such. But I think, obviously, the end product being something that's read, it seemed to us that it might be interesting to have a bit of a chat about that.
Yeah. I think we've kind of, obviously been slightly disrupted in our usual schedule in the last few months. So I think it's interesting to kind of take another look at, you know, how writing and reading relate to each other. And I think this episode, I can see where the conversation goes, but I think it's interesting to sort of maybe talk about sort of books that we read before or while we were writing in our early stages that kind of had an impact. And how reading does relate to the act of writing, because certainly I've noticed a slowdown amongst the lockdown at the moment in both activities.
Yeah, I mean, I think as we were chatting before we started recording this episode, I do feel like there's been two halves to my reading. I think when it first came, because of the way we were working from home, me and my partner splitting childcare and working, I managed to, just because how the day fell, I had a bit more time while our child was sleeping. So I was able to, if I wanted to use that as my break, like have a good chunk of reading, maybe get a good sort of 45 minutes in the middle of the day. And then something happened. I don't know, I was making loads of progress, really sort of tearing through quite a few books. And then it all sort of slowed down. And now I'm taking a long time to get through quite a short book. I wonder, it's this sort of being thrown off your axis a little bit. I think because the days get so similar while we're living in this sort of lockdown, that things start to feel like patterns quite quickly, but they are also sort of broken quite quickly as well.
Yeah, it's hard to, in a way, find things that to differentiate the day. Even when you are doing something different, it can quickly go from your memory.
Yeah.
And
I was one of those people who was setting myself tasks at the beginning, and doing well. Like I'm getting quite a lot of running, and I am writing every day, even if that is like a couple of sentences. Sometimes it's a lot more, but I'm at the moment very much that sort of early first draft stage, where it's a lot of note taking, gathering ideas, just gathering things that are the right feel, you know. So that's quite easy to be, if not incredibly productive, it's always easy to just grab, I've got a little bit of time here, I'm just gonna have a think, write a few notes down. And then you feel like you're making progress, even though, it's not, there's no shape to it.
Yeah, I do wonder that the sort of note taking and that phase of writing, I think it is kind of triggered a lot by going out, moving, being in places. But I think that's definitely slowed down, not going out.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Going out, scurrying for, you know, to the shop and back, and then and closing the door, rather than a sort of meandering around the city, taking things in and, you know, having random thoughts that I might jot down. And I wonder if that is related to that. I think that writing and reading are obviously so closely linked, but definitely felt a slowdown in in that sort of inspiration to write. And I think that's maybe had a knock-on effect in
it's this kind
sort of ability to read.
It's this odd sort of liminal phase though, isn't it? So it's sort of so there was a podcast I was listening to a while ago where they're talking about films and stuff, and films that deal with epidemics, and they were saying that, I mean, one of the reasons there might not be lots of films that really nail it, I know Contagion has been really popular, but is that it's actually this real grinding boredom and sort of stasis that is the thing that marks it out most. And that's obviously for any sort of art that deals with narrative or anything, or just changes of state, that it's not, there's not much there to it, is there? Other than obviously the drama of people becoming ill and, you know, but it's...
Yeah,
but I don't mean that in a different way, obviously. I just mean, like, you know, literally, if you become sick, then, yeah, there's a story to that. But and I know a lot of the fiction we deal with is not necessarily narrative fiction, but it's still, yeah, there's no sort of red meat to it.
And, yeah, the sort of, the way it is typically portrayed is a kind of dystopian, you know, even... as the government is doing everything wrong, it's still not, it's doing it in a farcical way rather than a particularly dystopian way. I mean, I guess there's elements of both, but at the moment, the main element appears farcical, not ineptitude, rather than the sort of high drama that you'd see in a
I guess, although I don't pandemic think people movie. Really have got down to the detail of the sort of emergency powers that the government have taken. Without anyone really making a peep about it, they have amassed a huge amount of power, even if it's like temporarily. But, you know, let's assume it's not going to go all to some dystopian hell and, you know, we'll all be okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure we can trust that lot in charge. They seem like stand-up guys with integrity, and you know, this is maybe not the podcast for that.
No. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the sort of everyday world that you enter outside the front door, there's nothing to kind of inspire so much. It's quiet. And there's elements of what you'd see in a pandemic movie with deserted streets, but it doesn't seem to resonate in the same way as watching a pandemic movie where, you know, London is deserted. It's kind of just a bit quiet rather than deserted. There's people going around in sort of homemade face masks rather than, you know, squads of people in hazmat suits clearing dead bodies from the street, which obviously no one wants to see, but in a film that kind of has a visceral feeling, whereas there's lack of any kind of,
it's the sort of sense, yeah, the banality of it. It's I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of art that comes out of this. I'm very skeptical that much of it is going to be any good, but I bet there will be in a sort of year and a half's time a lot of novels and stuff that deal with it. I hope people find interesting angles to take on it. But have you, on the subject of reading, when this started, have you been tempted to have a look at anything that deals with pandemics or epidemics or anything? Because I know that's something to be, reading lists suddenly appeared on Twitter.
Yeah, no, it's not something I've been drawn to. It's something I feel like I've kind of seen lots of different versions of that theme in the past, and some have been better than others, but it almost doesn't seem to relate what's going on at the moment to what you see in these films, purely because of the banality of everything. It doesn't sort of get you fired up creatively, or at least for me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a copy of the Decameron on my shelf for a long time, and I thought this is like the opportunity to get it. And I read it, and the sort of preamble is really interesting about the Black Death. But I think I just then, there are other things I wanted to read or just didn't, you know, I don't know, just somehow it didn't grab me. I mean, Camus' The Plague is one of my favorite books. I think it's amazing. And you know, I can see why people might be digging into that now. But again, that's about this kind of death stalking you and being trapped, you know, in a place. And I think, and this is not to like, you know, this country has got, what, the second highest death rate in the world, but it's not kind of, there's no sort of glamour to it. It seems to be like tearing through care homes and stuff. And it's not, you know, as young people, I know, you know, people of all ages have suffered from it and died, but it seems to be there's an economic danger and peril, and, you know, job security and stuff seems to be much, much more of a fear than going out the street. Now, I think we started to look at people. I think if you had to get on a train where it was absolutely packed, you might feel, and you know, some of our listeners might do that, you might feel much less secure about it. But yeah, it's not that everyone you see in the street is this threat in quite a way. I think that's at a low level, but not this, oh, you know, that might be the end of me if I come into contact with the wrong person.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting talking about Camus and the Plague, and for me, that book, I think, it's a really good book. Having read it, I don't feel like, oh, that's something that could only have been written by somebody who's had first-hand experience of a plague. It's operating on a sort of metaphorical level for me that is not really related. And I mean, I don't know, like you're saying, in terms of people, art being created in a year and a half's time or so on. I do wonder how much, like, all art has to be something that's done in retrospect. Like, while you're in the thick of it, it's almost too difficult to see or to create anything. It's only the interaction between the sort of memory or hindsight and a particular event that kind of leads to that.
I guess also
that leads to good art.
Yeah, but the I guess there's a setting or a theme or anything. Maybe the plague is an example of, and I was also thinking of Rhinoceros by Ionescu. So it's the plague itself and the contagion as a metaphor is much more compelling. And I guess that's what people would have to do with it. There's obviously growths of right-wing populism and things around Europe and stuff like that. So I could imagine that it would take in much broader themes to have something to say about a pandemic rather than just, you get ill.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the other thing, I guess, at the moment. It feels like it's not just a pandemic that's going on at the moment. There's a lot of sort of tectonic, socio-cultural forces at work that in a year and a half's time, it feels hard to predict where you know we're going to be, and you know that's kind of scary and exciting at the same time. But it's it kind of muddies the water in terms of what this means. Looking back in 10 years' time, what are we going to see this period as? Is it just a blip when there was a medical emergency and a medical crisis, or is it fermenting the start of something that's going to fundamentally change how we live in 5 years' time?
Yeah, I mean, that's, we're interesting. We're talking start the second week of June. So we're 2 weeks in to the George Floyd died in the US in the 20-somethingth of May. So the Black Lives Matter protests and stuff that have been going on have really been kicking off as well. So yeah, I can see that although that's the sort of timing that maybe wouldn't be planned, maybe that's fed into it. And yeah, you're sort of talking about the tectonic shifts that are happening. I mean, this has the potential to be much more significant.
In so many ways, in one scenario, by the end of the year, we could be back more or less to the society that was existing in January this year. But in countless other scenarios, that seems extremely unlikely. And what form those changes take is well, I think anyone's guess at the moment. Like economically, and I mean, also in terms of, you know, the environment and the, you know, we've seen a massive drop in emissions as everyone's stopped using oil and gas and stuff. But is that going to go back up again? Are we going to return, or do we even want to return to the way things were?
Well, it'll be a fight for the future, won't it?
Mm.
I think there's some people who have a really, for me, unpalatable future that they see. This is an opportunity to really force through the changes that they want. And I guess people from that side of politics would feel that the things that people like me want to happen in the world would be unpalatable for them. So yeah, it's a tricky old time.
Mm. I mean, there's a lot obviously to write about in that. But I mean, certainly in the last period of lockdown, I personally have noticed a slowdown in my writing, I don't know. I think it maybe does have a, because thinking about when I write, I do tend to write, go into cafes and sort of write stuff, jot stuff down, you know, in a notebook or a phone while I'm on the tube or that sort of thing, which that has changed. And obviously I'm not going out the same or on the tube or in cafes. So, that's limited my writing in that style. And
did that feel important to you before? How integral that was to your thought process and your writing, or is that only something you've realized since this has all happened?
I only just sort of realized it now talking. I guess it felt integral in that I would write it down when if I had a thought for a story or something, I would write it down there and then, because I was aware I might forget it. And if I was on the tube, then that would I'd use whatever was at hand to do it. So it wasn't ever something I sort of thought, oh, this is my plan, my framework for how I must write, and I'm going to do it. I've had an idea. I should jot it down, because from experience, I've not jotted down some ideas and then forgotten them, or yeah. I remembered there was aspects to the idea that are not so clear 3 days afterwards.
I mean, that feeling. I mean, sometimes I always have a phone on me now, and always a notepad anyway, but that back in the time before that, or when it would mean that you had to sort of go to some length to write something down, I'd sort of be, I'll remember that. I'll just really think about it. And then the next morning or whatever comes back to you, like, no, there was something else to it.
Hmm.
I mean, there's a couple of times I've just sort of had ideas. I'm like, it was too much of an effort. I don't know, late at night after being in the pub. And then I think, that's walking home. Like, oh yeah, that's a really, really good idea. That is, that really works. And just thinking, I probably won't remember it, but I think now, like, yeah, that's a good idea. But now that wouldn't happen. It's just a voice note away. So,
Thinking about like how I would normally take notes and things, there is a period as well that I would normally, I sort of almost need to sort of look at the idea from different angles, and that kind of involves being in different spaces, I guess, but not in a conscious way. Just I would tend to be in a different sort of mode when I'm traveling somewhere than I am sitting quietly in the room at home.
Yeah.
And if I'm only sitting at home, then I'm only kind of in one sort of mode, which is good for a certain kind of style of writing, but not so good in terms of generating the ideas or capturing the ideas or getting perspective on the idea, which I think is like the advantage of being places and moving.
Yeah.
Not so much I'm consciously looking at, like, I need to look at the idea from another angle. It's just, I'll have it at the back of my mind, and a different approach will maybe occur one day and then another day, and over a period of time, those kind of coalesce or orbit around each other until concrete comes together.
It's something we've covered, isn't it, with lots of people we've spoken to in this podcast about that really sort of unqualifiable sense that things just suddenly come screaming in from way out in your subconscious, and that suddenly links things together. And it's when you've been thinking about something completely different, or just there won't be any rhyme or reason, you're just, yeah, something suddenly pops into your mind, and then that's the bit that wasn't quite fitting, or yeah, things like that. But I mean, I'm saying that as quite a big sort of moving the scenery around sense. But yeah, for any little things, you'll suddenly just go, yeah, that's the feel of it. That's what, yeah, I've got that.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of your writing, there's sort of two halves to lockdown.
Well, that was with my reading, really.
Yeah. So, was that paralleled with a shift in writing, or have you been able to write throughout equally?
I think there's an artificial dividing line in that I read a book as some research for what I am writing, just to get some background kind of color. But I think what happened was that made me think, oh, I want to read another little bit of nonfiction. So I went through and I read Gombrich's Story of Art, because I was like, oh, like, you know, I love going to galleries and museums and stuff. But I think there's a lot of gaps in my knowledge. And I know this is basically like an A-level text or something, but I just thought I'll get a sort of survey of how art, especially in the West, has developed, and read that. And then I think since then, I found that a really accessible read, really engaging, really enjoyable. But then, you know how you just sometimes go through periods where you just don't find anything that quite grabs you? And I think plenty of things I've read have grabbed me, but you just go through a bit of a period where you're like, yeah, I've read some all right stuff, but nothing that really sticks out. And then I find this happens with music and films as well. Sometimes I just go through like a couple of months where there's no films that really, they were fine, but they don't really stick in your mind. And I always wonder if that's to do with coming to something at just the right time, or sometimes there were things that, I mean, maybe there are books that didn't really make a massive impression on me that I could have just read at a slightly different time in my life, something different going on, and they would have done.
Yeah, I think that definitely, I mean, that's I felt the sort of last few months, I just sort of not really found anything that I'm kind of getting into.
I found that with films, weirdly, and lots of films, because when I find this with books a lot, I do tend to like a lot of the books I read, but that's because, you know, really into fiction and writing and different approaches to it. So you kind of do a lot of due diligence, maybe unconsciously, but you kind of have an idea about what something is before you read it. And so you're sort of predisposed. Most things you're going to sort of generally like already when you come to it. But there's a lot of films of late, especially things that people have been raving about and that I really like the idea of, and then watch them. And I was like, yeah, that is a good film, but it's not like blow me away. And maybe the expectations start I mean, I don't want to throw any shade on anyone's creative works and say they're not as good as, it's not as good as everyone says. Because like we were saying, it's maybe this time when our heads are in a slightly weird place and just not quite taken to things.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot to say about the time and the sort of mental space you approach reading anything from, and I think that obviously has a huge impact. But there is a balance. Obviously, it can't purely be that. Otherwise, the difference in how you saw certain text would change dramatically depending on which day you looked at them, but that doesn't seem to be the experience. There is a sort of first impression that can kind of get hooks into you, but at the same time it feels like there's something intrinsic in the text that either resonates or not. But I guess there's no way to kind of ultimately decide that, because everyone only reads any text for the first time at a certain age, at a certain point of view, and you can read it again at another age with another point of view, but that again, that's the specific time that it's hard to disentangle the two. The kind of,
are you much of a rereader?
Not really, no. I mean, yeah, some books, but not, I mean, generally, no, and not, certainly not recently.
I mean, I would go along with that. I really feel like I'm on this earth for a set amount of, well, not a set, you know what I mean, for a finite amount of time. And life is probably a bit too short. I know some people who sort of have three or four books they love, they seem to reread every couple of years, but it's just not for me. And I am just getting over this, having a young child, having to finish books. And that's another thing about they're doing, as I say, the sort of due diligence beforehand. I've already sifted out whether I'm likely to like a book or not. And not saying I'll love it, but you know, it will be in my, what's it, in my wheelhouse or whatever. There's some saying related to that, isn't there? And that I have to, once I start, you know, get to the end of it, that's started to go away. But I think I've noticed, so there are a couple of books, both of which I loved the first time around, that I've read in the past, reread, I'd say, in the past 5 years. And one of them I was like, wow, what did I love so much about that? It's really not floating my boat. And one of them I was like, yeah, this is just as great a work as I thought it was. And I found more in it the second time, you know. So we thought we'd have a bit of a chat about this. This kind of segues into one of the themes we thought we might have a chat about. This is about books that sort of got us to the sort of writing that we're interested in now. So I think we both have an interest in sort of less conventional fiction. I mean, experimental is a tricky term. And I think some of the writers that we, I know I'm personally into, have had a problem with the term experimental fiction. But if we call it innovative literary fiction, people trying to do something different with the form or language, something like that. The path that got us to being into that, I thought we could talk about.
I think it is interesting the idea of rereading and like what the process of reading is. I mean, in a simple sense, obviously it has a straightforward meaning of, you know, pointing your eyes at words and understanding what they mean and moving on to the next set of words. But I can, in terms of reading novels, being drawn to books that are not necessarily, it's not always, I don't associate reading with necessarily being an enjoyable pastime or a place where I'm just captivated away. I kind of want to read something that challenges me in a way, and that might be challenging to concentrate or to actually, you know, read a whole page and take it in and move on to the next page. It's not a kind of, I mean, I have obviously read page turners, and that there is a kind of experience tied to that that is enjoyable in a way, but it's less and less. So I'd like a 400 page sort of plot driven page turner type book I would kind of shy away from now.
I mean, I remember when we were first sort of, you know, meeting up for the odd drink and talking about our writing, and I said, because I was very much feeling that film is now the sort of main storytelling medium. Literally for a plot, and that I'm sort of reducing film and what it can do quite a lot there, because there's a lot of interesting things you can do. But I think for most people, for their consumption, film is where they go for stories. And I'm sort of feeling, well, the novel has been around for long enough now that it could do some, you know, we need to explore what the novel is, as a form, can do, and what's interesting about it, and what's sort of integral to it and unique to it. And I said in a slightly scathing way, like, well, you know, if it's just some narrative fiction, like, why don't you just go and make it into a film? And you said, possibly with less effect of the lager on you, well, yeah, but how much does it cost to go and make a film? How much does it cost to write? Which I think is fair. And I think you were defending a slightly extreme position that I was taking. I think it's, yeah, I think that's sort of a fair point. But I think, yeah, to look at what fiction can do, what prose fiction can do, and where we can take it. It's been around for such a long time, and it just makes my heart heavy that there's this heritage industry of just reproducing the Victorian novel, essentially, but it's got emails in it. I don't know, what's the point? But yeah, you know, the people that love that, that's fine. I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't want to deny the existence of any writing. If people want to read whatever they want to read, that's fine. And the market is more on their side than my side. So, you know, what does that say about
it? I think there is any sort of writing, it connects, I think, can connect in a different way than film does, even if it's doing more or less the same job on the face of it. I've read bits of Harry Potter, but I've never read a whole book. And for me, it's very much in the simple page turner style of writing. But obviously for a lot of people, that has a really profound meaning, and as a book that they read as a child, it's impacted how they see the world,
yeah,
which is kind of what I want a book to do. But I would, yeah, it's hard to do that in a sort of plot driven format, I think, beyond kind of children's literature, when obviously children are approaching the world in a slightly different mental state than adults do.
Yeah, I mean, Harry Potter was sort of an interesting one. I think obviously we were a bit old for it when it came out as a book, so I never read it or was interested in reading it, really. But I think it was also marketed to adults, wasn't it? Was it marketed to adults, or they published it with covers that were less childish so that adults would feel less, which is a weird thing. But that was sort of the first. I don't know if that really happens now either. But this slightly links to something that we've also talked about, in that I mean, you know, I have a few pints and then get very strong opinions about things. But I've also been quite withering about young adult YA as a genre. And this really links to what we were talking about our journeys in reading to get here. It feels like such a marketing thing to have YA. And I get, like, if that's getting some kids reading, okay, that's fair enough. But I always thought, like, the point of it, that one of the reasons I really loved books when I was a teenager was there was no age classification on books. And when you're like, you know, 12 years old and stuff, no one's going to say to you, oh, you can't buy this. Someone's not necessarily going to recommend it to you, but you can take books off the shelves and stuff and read them. And there's the most sort of fucked up stuff happening in it. And you just think, you know, wow, this is, there's no way. I mean, obviously, people don't wait till they're 18 to watch an 18 rated film, but it's like this sort of secret world that you could go and read, and it would just sort of blow your mind and sort of pull down your naivety. And I found that really exhilarating and really, like, exciting about the worlds, I mean, that opened up that weren't kind of gate kept away from you.
Yeah. I think going back to the sort of link between reading and writing as well, I think it is exciting to sort of realize that there's books that, you know, it can be so easy to create a book, like talking about films in comparison. And yeah, as I was saying about the budget it takes to produce a film, it seems so much further away from somebody who's not involved in the film industry at all to watch a Hollywood blockbuster. Say that's just, you're not feasibly, you can't even imagine how it's made. Whereas reading a book that it kind of connects to you and you can sort of see what the writer is doing or get what you think they're doing, but see that, you know, it's just, they've just put words on the page one after the other and it's kind of strung together this fantastic story. Yeah, I think I can, yeah, help when your brain kind of connects the act of reading and writing together.
And I think the power of first person as well as a perspective, I think that does something that film rarely does. I know there's some films and TV shows that are made purporting to be sort of first person, but I think, yeah, the way that you can outline mental states and things like that. What did you say? What did you, when you were a teenager, what sort of stuff did you read?
I read like a lot of sort of, I guess, kind of sci-fi, like Philip K. Dick. I was quite into, I remember reading like Lanark by Alistair Gray, which I think that was the book that very much I kind of saw the sort of craftsmanship seems very on show in a way.
Yeah.
I guess because I'm Scottish and it sort of referenced a lot of kind of small details about Scottish life, but in this sort of grand, fantastical way that kind of quickly exploded these small details into sort of almost dreamlike places that and kind of jumping between narratives, and it felt very, very playful. It seemed very obvious reading Lanark that the author was not somebody sat in an ivory tower writing serious prose, even though it felt very serious at the same time standing back from it. But the process of reading it, it felt like, oh, I could almost write this. This is not so hard. But
did you read that as a teenager, did you say?
Yeah.
Right, because I love that book. I read it probably in my mid-20s, but that was definitely one of the books I really, that sort of showed me what you could do and the sort of lack of rules about stuff.
And it felt kind of, it was clear it wasn't kind of plot driven, but it kind of carried you along nonetheless without seeming too dense or complicated, even though there was lots of sort of complication within it.
I think it's, I mean, it's a book with a very interesting compositional history, isn't it, as well? I mean, it's sort of, you can see that it's parts of a different sort of parts put together, things that he wrote, I don't know, what was it, 30 years before the other bits, or maybe longer. Yeah, I think it's interesting. One of the books that I noted down, and this goes back to my thing about having access to this very adult world, was actually Trainspotting, which I read, I think I was 13 when I read it, and it was, the film had been announced, and I remember that my parents used to watch Hamish Macbeth on like Sunday evenings or whatever it was, and I just remember seeing something like the Sunday paper or something about the guy from that's doing this film, and I didn't really know much about it. We went on holiday and I saw the book at the airport and I just thought, okay, I'm going to get that and read it. And then I just, reading that at that age, I was thinking, what the hell is this? But I think it was really good for, again, because I mean, I was formerly, it's fairly linear in terms of the chronology, but obviously it's written in, well, people correct me and say it's not technically Scots, but it's, the way it's written, what's happening with the language in that, I think is really quite eye-opening. And the fact that, you don't have to write a book that's in really standard English to get it published and for it to be successful.
I think there's the sort of dividing line between reading and writing is interesting when the voice changes to something quite different from standard, like the standard English. I had the same experience with Trainspotting. It's like, wow, this is, you can write like that. I didn't know that almost, even though it's obviously you can write anything, but it kind of opens your eyes to, well, if I'm reading this, then somebody must be writing like that. So yeah, maybe I can write in experiment in different ways. I think we were saying earlier on about experimental. It is a funny word that in one sense it kind of entices me that experimental fiction, it's doing something interesting to look at what fiction can be, but at the other end it kind of puts me off in the sense that it's almost deliberately antagonistic to the reader somehow, which I don't think it has to be, but there are a lot of experimental texts that just don't do anything for me, and I feel like I've wasted time reading that almost.
Yeah, I was thinking about this when we talked about this for the episode. I thought of a really good analogy for it, and I can't quite record it now, but there was a difference between whether you feel like the writer isn't quite in control of what they're doing, it being an experiment anyway, but if they maybe don't understand the terms really of what they were doing, or it doesn't feel like they do, that can be very frustrating. But sometimes if it feels like they're just batting you about a little bit, like a cat toying with a mouse for their, just because they can, because they're so in control of what they're doing, then sometimes that can be quite exhilarating, even if it is a sort of an alienating experience to read. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, that element of trust with the writer is quite important. Do you feel you kind of trust where they're going with it?
Yeah.
And then that almost adds to the experience. Looking back, if you kind of trust where the writer's going with it, you're kind of going to get involved with the text more, and then by the time you've finished it, you get more out of it. Whereas certainly some texts are sort of read not 100% convinced where the writer's going, and the more I read, the more it kind of annoys me almost.
Yeah.
Which it may just be that text and me don't get on, or I don't know, because it's obviously a hard thing to quantify, like how you trust writer, because all you're going on is the words on the page, and I mean, unless you actually know them personally, but in the majority of books you read, you never met the author, and you don't know anything about them other than a short blurb on the back of the book. And
yeah, and I guess particularly with the more obscure ends of literature, you get, you won't have seen any documentaries or anything about them, or any real in-depth articles. And then sometimes that sort of adds to it, doesn't it? I like that, the sort of tricky verisimilitude of things. You're not quite sure, like, is this real? Especially when there's like really crazy stuff going on, like, is that, I don't know, it's difficult to tell what they've actually gone through here. And I think some writers are very happy to kind of toy with that a bit, aren't they? I mean, I think I mean, did you grow up in a house full of books, or were you sort of
but not a lot of things. I mean, yeah, there was fiction, but I grew up. I read a lot, but sort of go to the library every week and get a handful of books or whatever, and there were books, but it wasn't like a lot of the books in my house were sort of nonfiction or I don't know. Yeah, I guess I'm trying to think what fiction read. Yeah, there was a lot, but it wasn't, I guess it was just on the bookshelf. I sort of slowly came across it, but I don't remember sort of discovering this author and that author from books at home. It was more the library. And
I think I generally I'm just trying to remember what it was like, but especially sort of as a teenager, I think I was one of those kids who had a sort of magpie eye for the obscure or people trying to do things that are interesting. And I don't know if that was like a sort of willful, I don't know what people sort of call hipsterness these days, but I do remember like I would read in a sort of article or something, there'd be a mention of writers who were doing sort of things with sort of philosophical novels or existential things, you know, and I would be like, oh, this sounds like an interesting thing to explore. And my mum would have quite a wide range of books. I'm sure they're my dad's books as well, but that I would then go and look, and there would be sort of, you know, Franz Kafka, Albert Camus, Jean Genet, and Hubert Selby Jr. and things like that on the shelves. So I think I just sort of struck lucky. I mean, I would read about these people, think, oh, that sounds interesting, and then the book would be there to read. Because this is pre-internet, isn't it, that we're talking about? So not really like, there wasn't that way of finding a sort of good recommendations all piled in together that would then lead you onto other things through online communities or anything like that. It was just, yeah, you'd read, and then you'd be reading something about the writers you've been familiar with, and they'd mention someone else, and think, oh, okay, I'll go and check that out. And some of it would fall by the wayside, and some of it would, really sort of grab you.
Yeah, yeah. Different way of coming across stuff before the internet. It's hard to remember. I think I remember sort of like hoping to find that sort of sort of serendipity of, oh, look in the shelves and there'll be some amazing book that'll blow my mind. But it's more sort of, I don't know, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Is that even the title? Kind of, this is a bit dull. Yeah. It's not really, I think a lot more sort of non-fiction stuff, but not so much Camus or Kafka.
I think one of the ones that really had an absolute complete shift of mindset and just took me on a massive journey is such a random discovery. For a brief while when we were just teenagers and hanging around at a mate's free house, his parents gone on holiday, we were just smoking weed and drinking all day. And the film Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels had come out. So I watched that a bit. And a few years later, I was in, I don't know, HMV or Virgin or wherever in Oxford. And there was a film that had, I think it was Nick Moran, the guy from that, in it. And I just bought this DVD. I think it was like £2, £3, really cheap. And I thought, okay, I'll buy that, and took it home and sort of probably watched it a couple of times. It was an interesting story. But it was the film of Christy Mallory's own double entry by B.S. Johnson. And I don't know if I'd even heard of B.S. Johnson, but I was speaking a few years later and just had, you know, DVDs knocking around. And I mentioned to a friend of mine, this guy's a bit older, about having this film. And he said, oh my God, I can't imagine how they would ever make a film of that book. And I said, we sort of had a chat about it, and he lent me the book, and it just completely blew my mind. I mean, that's the book I referred to earlier about having reread and just still loving. I think it's like, amazing. And opening up B.S. Johnson for me and going through all of his work and all the stuff that's led me onto. But that all came through Guy Ritchie's Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels.
Unusual.
I mean, I was already like primed to be interested in this, and obviously you can only read as much as you can read. I guess I like to think I still would have come to B.S. Johnson, but that completely, for my own writing and stuff, and for really getting me writing regularly. Back in the day, I'd write little bits down, have little ideas for things, but never really get going. And reading that and thinking, Jesus fucking Christ, you can do, like, you can do anything you want, as long as you understand the rules and the the terms in which you're engaging with this, you can do anything, you know, and it's got to hold together. It's got to be good. It's got to be well-crafted, but, you know, it doesn't have to look like a Victorian novel.
No, no. I've not seen that film. Is it a good interpretation?
I mean, it's not, it's fine, but I just think what the book is, it's nothing. I mean, I haven't seen it for, I don't know, 15 years maybe. but I don't recall it being, I mean, it was all right. Like I say, I bought it for really dirt cheap. Back at the time when I don't know how space wasn't an issue. I wasn't really a prolific buyer of DVDs, but I think I had an eye for a bargain and I thought, oh, that looks good. It's got terrible cover art. That's the thing I remember about it. And I think the ending's slightly different. But the whole book, because it's metafiction, is really like playing with the fact that, you know, Christie is this character that's being read and all this sort of stuff. And it makes references to, oh, there's only X many pages to go or words to go or whatever, you know, and it really plays with that. So I don't think the film does anything along those lines, if I remember rightly. I don't think the fourth wall is broken or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder in terms of writing now and like metafiction and that kind of, you know, breaking the fourth wall and playing around experimentally with the form in that way, if it's almost, you're kind of immersed in that so much just looking at Twitter or online. I do wonder how that advances in the kind of prose form.
Yeah. I wonder, although these things often only make sense in retrospect, don't they? So it's sort of, yeah, but that's true, yeah. And the kind of memification of everything and all, how sort of codified everything is and this sort of own, it's its own language.
Yeah, it's to think of, you know, books that do what B.S. Johnson's doing, but contemporary novels, it's hard to think, but I mean, that's maybe just because B.S. Johnson was doing something unique and he happened to do it then. If he'd been alive now, he would have done it now. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like a lot of what, I mean, Alistair Gray was doing some of those sort of similar things, wasn't he? And yet he wasn't considered part of that group, maybe because he was writing quite separately. And I mean, Anne Quinn has enjoyed a sort of lot more attention of late, and she was doing more sort of challenging things. But yeah, these writers do each seem to be quite singular, as much as they were sort of put together as a scene. I mean, that's one of the things I did at the start of the lockdown when I was reading. I said I was really getting through stuff. I read all of Alan Burns's novels from start to finish, and he has the virtue of writing all of his novels, but in the first one, which is even shorter, but they're about 140 pages each. And that's sort of interesting to see the different types of experimentation and sort of cut up and everything. But I think there's, yeah.
Yeah, I've not read any of his. Has he got quite a few?
Yeah, and Alma Books put out, as part of their sort of colder imprint, I think about a couple of years ago, they put out the first few. I mean, it's sort of interesting to read, yeah, from that period, you know, in the 60s when there were everything sort of exploded and there were lots of different ideas being tried out. Yeah, because I think that sort of, from reading people like that, led me on to the Nouveau Roman stuff. And I think within that, there's a lot of, there's some interesting ideas, and there's also some books that really don't seem to work. Because I think reading like Alain Robbe Grier, and I'm sorry to everyone who speaks French for how bad my French pronunciation is, remains sort of an interesting writer. And I think there's even, I think Tom McCarthy has written quite a bit about him and stuff like that. So I think it's sort of still got a lot of currency. But then there's some of the other books that just seem, yeah, sort of willfully experimental and maybe were able to cross a bar in the 1960s to publication because they had really advocate publishers who were really happy to push it. that maybe don't bring too much to the party.
I don't know. But then it's interesting, like, think of how personally you react to the same book differently at different times. You know, a book in itself can be completely differently received, you know, 50 years later than, or, you know, 100 years later. There's a different mindset, and people read it in a different way. To do more with the kind of the general societal kind of perspective on it, rather than the individual relationship. That, you know, the books that might have read and thought, oh, that just kind of that passed the bar because of some circumstances, but it's not a great book, that in another 30 years they look back on and think, oh yeah, they were doing something different. Maybe the author wasn't even trying to do what they think they were.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
Time.
Yeah.
I guess that's what generally with more experimental work, there's sort of a wider weave between the words that lets a broader kind of range of interpretations on the book, and how that can be positive or negative.
But, yeah.
It's kind of hard to bring too many interpretations onto to something that's very plot driven and quite concrete in terms of what is or isn't happening in the text.
Well, yeah, I mean, last year when I was doing the shared parental leave, I was reading Finnegan's Wake. I was reading it out loud, the first half of it, to my daughter, not in one go. That would be psychopathic. but I just, you know, I wanted to read it. I was having this time, so it felt like a good time to give it a go. And I thought it would just be funny for her to be able to say that the first book that her father ever read to her was Finnegan's Wake. I mean, it would put me in a very bad light, but, you know, what are you going to do? And so I read a bit around that, a bit about it as well. And they were sort of saying that a lot of the critical writing was basically saying that you can really project anything. You know, every reader will have so many things that the associations that the language fires off, that it will be like a completely unique book to everyone who reads it. And I guess to a greater and lesser extent, that's true with most books.
Thanks for listening. You can find us, as always, in the usual places, on Twitter at Unsound Methods, or online, we're at unsoundmethods.co.uk, and you can find me in my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or on Twitter, I'm Lachlan Bloom,
and my writing is at jamiebatchin.com, spelt in my odd way, at Jamie Batchin on Twitter, or at Jamie_Batchin on Instagram. Thank you for listening. Talk to you again soon.